from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
I'm always an optimist, and maybe that's one of my fatal flaws.
You know, maybe if the majority leader of the Senate spent less time tweeting 15-year-old tweets and focused on what he got elected to do, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation.
There is nothing unreasonable about manufacturing an AR-15.
I yield the floor.
Bravo.
I understand money better than anybody.
It is not my job to tell delegates what to do, what not to do, or to weigh in on things like that.
Cleveland!
Some of the news of the week out of context. Here to add some context for us, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us today is Christine Storch. She's the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hi, Christine.
Good morning, John.
And Dan Haar. He's a columnist for The Hartford Current. Hello once again, Danny.
Hello, John.
And you can join the conversation in The Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Less than an hour and a half after we ended our show last week, Senator Chris Murphy started his now famous filibuster that lasted more than 14 hours. It came in the wake of the Orlando nightclub shooting. He stopped business in the Senate to talk about new gun measures. Those measures were brought up for a vote on Monday evening, and all were rejected, including a ban on selling guns to those on the terrorist watch list. After the vote, here's some of what Murphy had to say.
After September 11th, we decided that we weren't going to allow terrorists to get a hold of airplanes in order to kill civilians. Well, today they've moved on to assault weapons. They specifically recruit lone wolf attackers to go to gun shows to buy assault weapons. And we should take the same tact.
Now, on that same day the Senate voted on these gun measures, there were developments in two court cases related to this issue. I'll be bringing up those in just a moment. But first of all, Colin, your reaction. We shouldn't be surprised that the vote in the Senate went this way, but an awful lot of the air went out of the balloon that started to blow up on the Senate floor last week.
Yeah, although I think maybe they had gamed a lot of this out, the fact that they probably weren't going to win. They were trying to get this vote. I mean, last Wednesday when we didn't know about the filibuster, I did say that we were really talking about the wedgiest issues. I mean, particularly probably access to guns for people on the terrorist watch list. They are probably more setting this up as an election issue than anything else. And Chris Murphy said after the failed votes this week that he would be, I mean, assuming anybody wants him to, which I think people probably will, he will be visiting some of the states where some of the Republican senators who voted no are up for reelection and campaigning on behalf of whoever is running as a Democrat. You know, I think these are, particularly that one, that issue polls very well. It polls way, way better than just gun control as an amorphous concept polls. So, you know, in some ways they may have kind of gotten what they wanted. I mean, I know genuinely they would have liked some of these basic common sense gun measures, but having not gotten them, they can conceivably, anyway, if they do it right, run on them.
Run on them, and Chris Murphy, Christine, seemingly has made this his number one issue. He's gained an awful lot of national attention for it. It feels like this is the Chris Murphy issue that we'll be hearing time and time again, including up through this election cycle as he beats on gun control.
Yeah, I guess what's kind of interesting as I'm kind of thinking about it in a political sense is that Dick Blumenthal is the one who's up for re-election this year, and Chris Murphy has another few years on his term, and you know that Richard Blumenthal has to be a little bit upset that Chris Murphy has the spotlight right now on this issue.
I was thinking the exact same thing in 2004 with the insurance, the big national insurance lawsuit. Spitzer upstaged Blumenthal, who was already at the time working on those same suits, and now his junior senator colleague upstages him. But really, I think we have to give Richard Blumenthal more credit than that. He likes to get out in public, but he's a big-hearted guy, and he understands that this is not about Dick Blumenthal, I think. And I just want to make the point that if the Democrats and broadly the left on gun control want to make headway, they should really lower the moral outrage a little bit, in much the same way that the social services left lowered the moral outrage in favor of making an economic argument. In this case, it's not an economic argument. It's a public safety argument. But I really would like to see the volume turned down on the moral outrage. We get it.
Talk about that a little bit more, though. I mean, isn't the moral outrage the driving force behind an awful lot of what the grassroots of America are saying about this. I mean, when you see the polls that Chris Murphy cites about how people feel about gun control, about how they feel about things like getting terrorists who are on the watch or on the terrorist watch list unable to buy guns, when you hear some of these stories, isn't that what it's about? It's about moral outrage.
Well, there is moral outrage, and I feel moral outrage, and we all feel it, but so do the Republicans. And there's a disconnect, which Colin is about to fill, which is the difference, the distance between people can get guns and people are shooting other people. The various cases I've looked at, and I went over some of this last night, there's not a whole lot of incidents where there's a real clear line between lax gun control, which, yes, we do have, especially the background check aspect, not so much the terrorism list, and mass shootings. And so I'd like to see more logic and less more talk about policy and less moral outrage.
I think there's also just sort of a disconnect between what works with us and what works maybe with people out there in the rest of the world. So what works with us typically is, you know, I mean, President Obama is the embodiment of this essentially kind of logical statement. You know, he'll go, look, well, I think that, you know, we don't want to people on the terrorist watch list to get guns. That's common sense, you know, and we all go, yeah, that's how we feel. You know, Murphy is now saying the Republicans want to sell guns to ISIS. That's his current, you know, which Danny's right. That's an overstatement. But maybe they're feeling that they lose these battles because they're too reasonable, because they don't kind of play dirty. So they're going to play dirty.
Well, and part of what happened too, and what we heard about Colin after our program last week when I was on the nose and we were talking about the filibuster. Is, you know, there's an awful lot of fact-checking about some of the claims that Senator Murphy made on the floor, and he was playing a little loose with several of the facts around gun deaths and how many actual homicides are caused by guns, et cetera, et cetera. Is he going a little too far in trying to make this case that, as Danny said, a lot of people already want to believe in? It's just he's maybe using facts and saying things in a way that isn't going to resonate.
Right. So, first of all, it turns out I don't know how to impersonate President Obama. I never tried before. But
we're getting lots of calls, actually.
Yeah. So, second of all, I don't know to what degree does a 15-hour filibuster have to be held to the same fact-checking standards that maybe we would apply to something a little less exotic and a little less bizarre. Over the course of 15 hours trying to keep something going, yeah, he probably said some things that maybe crossed a line or weren't purely factual or stuff like that. You kind of hope that overall, as this issue is debated in serious, you know, in other words, you know, when it's actually debated on the floor of the Senate as opposed to being debated in a 15-hour filibuster, which is basically a stunt, you know, to try to get the bills called, you hope anyway that the standard for accuracy and truthfulness is a little bit higher when there's actually something on the line. I've seen some objections to stuff that he said during the filibuster. Well, it's a filibuster. I mean, half the time people are just like reading the Constitution out loud.
He didn't go into Dr. Seuss, so let's give him that.
Yeah, Ted Cruz famously read it, Green Eggs and Ham, yes, on the floor of the Senate.
So I think it's a really thorny issue, though, because you look at since December, Governor Malloy has been asking the federal government to either give access to or allow somehow Connecticut's background checks to be checked against these federal watch lists. And the no-fly list is the smallest of the federal watch lists we're talking about here. So the White House counsel still has not been able to give Connecticut a decision on that.
When it comes to the no-fly list and enforcing a no-gun provision, right, of that, I think both sides are right in this, in that the Democrats are saying you can't do it without background checks because there's no point in having a background loophole if you're going to be on the terrorist list and can't buy guns. And the Republicans are saying you can't do it without due process. So that's why the Susan Collins amendment, which says there will be not background checks, but at least on the what the Republicans want, which is due process, that is the right to a hearing with the government having the burden of proof. I think that's fair.
And this is the Maine Senator Susan Collins. I want to turn to those other cases that were happening at the same time. The first one involves a lawsuit filed against the gun maker Remington by families of the Newtown school shooting victims. Here's Remington attorney James Vogts speaking in Bridgeport Court.
If a manufacturer is not there to assess the incompetency or competency of the entrustee, how can it ever be shown that the manufacturer knew or reasonably should have known of that person's incompetence.
And now here's Josh Koskoff. He's an attorney for the families in the case.
There is nothing unreasonable about manufacturing an AR-15. It's what they do with it after it's manufactured, which determines whether they are acting responsibly.
So basically, Colin, this case that is being heard in Bridgeport Superior Court, this is a case that involves the 2013 ban on assault weapons. This case is essentially something that Newtown families have been trying to do for quite some time. What they're essentially saying is, look, these are guns that are made for war. They shouldn't be entrusted to people like you and me who don't have the skill or the training to have these guns. It's gotten a lot further, frankly, than other cases like this have, in part because it's in state court, not in federal court. The judge is going to rule on whether or not this case has merit. If indeed it does, in her eyes, it's not going to go to trial until something like 2018. After listening to a little bit of the arguments the other day, what do you see in this case?
Well, I mean, I think so. First of all, what we should say is the reason it doesn't go very far in federal courts is because there's an actual law excluding gun manufacturers from liability. It's a law that should not exist. There's just no carve out like that for anybody else. It's the result of having a very, very well funded, very powerful lobbying operation. And if I were the gun manufacturers, what would make me nervous about this suit would be an eventual appeal on its constitution, on the constitutionality of the PRCAA or whatever that law is called. In other words, you know, this law basically deprives people of what's ordinarily a right of redress, you know, in order to, you know, to seek damages and wind up in Ralph Nader's Tort Museum. You know, I mean, and so I would be – I'm not Dahlia Lithwick. I'm not Rennie Fulco. I'm not a constitutional scholar. But if I were working for a gun manufacturer, I'd be thinking, well, what I really don't want is this thing to make its way through the court system and somehow or other wind up in the Supreme Court where that the constitutionality of that law, particularly, say, in a Hillary Clinton presidency where she's maybe replaced a few Supreme Court judges, that would make me nervous.
And again, this 2005 law that Colin is talking about, Dan, is a law that was passed with quite a bit of bipartisan support, I might add. It wasn't just Republicans. There was a lot of support on the Democratic side as well for this bill, which shields gun makers from liability for people using guns in the way they're meant to be used, like shooting people with them.
There's nothing wrong with the law. And, of course, it became a big fight with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. The law just simply says that manufacturers and distributors can't sell guns negligently in ways that are not what they were made for. This is a legislative issue. This is a big, fat waste of time. Koskoff's argument is akin to saying a reporter can write a libelous story, you just can't report it. Right? It's splitting hairs. This Oklahoma case involving a construction company that gave a cherry bomb to a kid who gave it to another kid who blew her hand off is saying that that's equivalent to the proper sale of a gun under current legislation is just silliness, and it's a waste of everybody's time, and it's not going anywhere. The Supreme Court ruling, which we're going to talk about, was a victory for the other side. This is going to be a loss for this side, and people should stop hanging their hats on specious legal arguments.
Christine?
No, that's an interesting argument. I was just going to say that, you know, under Connecticut's assault weapons ban, there are, you know, at least 100 assault weapons that are now banned, and they're listed in the law. That was that the Supreme Court decided not to rule on this week, but that gun manufacturers will find a way around that. They'll find a way to manufacture a gun that doesn't fit those definitions and is similar to an AR-15.
Well, and that has happened before. It happened when there was an assault weapons ban back in the 1990s. And I think part of your point, Dan, is that let's say this all went through and it's judged that the AR-15 is akin to a military weapon. It shouldn't be sold to civilians for that reason. Then some version of the AR-15 that fits the specifications laid down by the law will then be made.
Well, the irony is that the Connecticut law, being relatively isolated, I think New York and California have versions of it, but Connecticut is the strictest version with zero military characteristics, does effectively ban it in Connecticut because it doesn't make economic sense for a company to build a gun just for Connecticut. If other states start to join in, then Christine's point will be exactly
okay.
What happens.
Yep.
And before I hear from Colin, I'll just say to pick up on Christine's point before, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear this case. It would challenge the 2013 law, the ban on assault weapons that followed the Newtown shooting. hearings, in not hearing that case call in the court, basically said that Connecticut's ban is legal.
Yeah. So let's just quickly go back. I wanted to make one sort of Ralph Nader-ish tort museum point about what Danny said about this lawsuit. And I really don't feel qualified to pronounce one way or another on the merits of this lawsuit. Oh, but great. I mean, but nor are you, actually.
Yeah, so. Thanks for that.
I think
there's a consensus here. Actually, none of us are.
But go ahead. You can analogize a little bit to a lot of other tort cases where, in fact, a company has failed to respond to a problem with their products. So,
yes.
I mean, look at the McDonald's coffee case. People don't understand that case very well. But one of the reasons the initial judgment by the jury was so high against McDonald's was there's this huge file of people who'd been injured by this coffee before it hurt this old lady, you know? And so the jury looked at this and said, you haven't done anything about this problem. You knew you had a problem. You didn't do anything about it. So at least at that level, a skilled attorney might be able to make the point, look at all the people who die from these things, and you don't do anything to make them safer. You don't put, you know, trigger locks on them. You don't put, you know, the thing that they were talking about on Morning Edition, the new sort of iPhone-style keypad. You don't do anything to make these things safer, and people keep getting killed. That's negligence. So, you know, there may be kind of an interesting argument by a skilled attorney. Now, to the thing that the Supreme Court didn't hear, so this is basically – this is sort of the reverse of this. You know, this is essentially gun manufacturers and gun enthusiast organizations trying to overturn Connecticut's ban on AR-15s. They lost at the lower court with Jose Cabranes, and the Supreme Court wouldn't grant them cert. I think what you're seeing here – look, the Supreme Court is going to hear a gun case post-Heller at some point, right? That's the last time that they ruled on this was the D.C. Handgun ban. And I'm sure they're kind of looking for a case to hear. However, I don't think they're looking for a case to hear when they have eight justices. I think ultimately whatever they're going to do – you know, they're probably going to wait until they're at a full nine to do it because having eight justices, first of all, there's the possibility of a deadlock. Nobody wants that. I'm guessing that may have had something to do with their reluctance to grant cert on this. And also, this just may not be the case that they're interested in.
This is a big deal following, as you said, Heller and McDonald in Chicago, because we have out there, floating out there, the constitutional right to have and use a gun for self-defense. Somebody pointed out that it's not that long a right and that it was just those two cases that established it out of 225 years or however old the country is. This is a big deal, but this is also pitting two conservative principles against each other. One is states' rights and the other is the Second Amendment. And I think the conservative wing of the party of the court is going to be loath to take away the right of states to do the sorts of things they want to do.
Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. When we come back, we're going to turn away from some of the big federal issues and gun issues. We're going to turn to the state capitol for some things. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Joining me today is Dan Haar. He's a columnist for The Hartford Courant, Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, who is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today at 1?
Well, we've had kind of a hard week on The Colin McEnroe Show. But let's just say, hypothetically, we got a whole show on the air and nothing went wrong technically or otherwise. We'd be doing a show on the concept of borders, and not just sort of the wall in Mexico, all kinds of borders. First of all, why some of the states in the United States are shaped the way they are, and why there's a notch in Connecticut. We're also going to be talking about the notion that the Sykes-Picot division of the Middle East is responsible for all the trouble over there. We have a guest who says, well, it's really kind of an overstatement. But we're also going to talk about walls and borders and how walls sometimes incentivize people to make tunnels and stuff like that. It's sort of like the natural human reaction to a wall is, oh, well, let's build something else.
Well, one of the interesting stories I've heard leading up to the Brexit vote tomorrow is whether or not a wall will have to go back up in Northern Ireland once again. If indeed the UK decides to leave the EU, all of a sudden there might be a wall again between the two parts of Ireland.
Yeah, and the Brexit vote, let's face it, it really is all about borders, really. I mean, it's about nothing else, really, and it's about the fact that as an island nation – Britain thinks about itself very differently from the rest of Europe. And so they don't see this free movement of goods and capital and personnel as a good thing. They see it as bloody immigrants.
So that's coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. I will tell you that this afternoon at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. Colin calls it the International Festival of Arts, Ideas, and Pancakes.
Which I just found out they really hate, which makes me want to do it more.
I'll actually be at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas this afternoon at the British Art Museum, of all things, talking about renewable energy, power from the earth. It's a panel discussion, part of their Ideas series. Hope you can join me this afternoon at 5:30 for that.
Well, museum might not even be there next year. They may leave.
They may split from New Haven. A settlement has been reached between the State Democratic Party and elections regulators related to the campaign mailers that went out in support of Governor Dan Malloy's 2014 reelection bid. The party will pay $325,000. To the state. Now, it's an awful lot of money paid to the state. The judge still has to approve the settlement. Not surprisingly, Republicans and a lot of people who look for, you know, good, clean government in the state are not too happy about this. What's the big downside to this for you, Colin, to the settlement?
The downside is we only have a 7-second delay, so all the things that I might really want to say about this, some of them might actually get on the air. Now, this is an appalling decision on so many different levels, and I don't want to I'm sure the other panelists have lots of things to say. I mean, the first conclusion that one would be forgiven for drawing from this is that there is an amount of money that you can pay to make a prosecution stop. You know, I mean, this was a settlement that was arrived at while, in fact, there was a whole argument going on about jurisdiction and a whole argument going on about discovery, specifically discovery of emails that were germane to this the whole question of how this money wound up, where it wound up. And so in order to make this go – now, I don't even understand we call it SEEK, the State Elections Enforcement Committee. I don't even understand SEEK's reasoning here. I mean, do they need this to go play Keno or something? Why do they – I mean, so they said – apparently they must have said, $100,000? No, we'd probably still have to prosecute you. Oh, $325,000? Okay, no, that's good because we have to paint the offices. So good. Well, give us that money and we'll stop prosecuting. I mean, I honest to God, don't get this. My blood pressure is going up. Somebody else talk.
Christine?
I'm with Colin. Like, I don't understand why they settled. It is now a settlement that applies only to the SEC and the Connecticut Democratic Party. So if this issue arises with any other campaign or party committee, we're right back at square one.
Well, not so much square one. I mean, the SEC would say we're at a very nice square. We're at a square at which you can pay $325,000 and make this whole
true.
Thing go away.
Yeah, exactly.
So they've arrived at a very nice square for themselves.
Yeah. No, it's just a bad settlement.
You have to have either four houses or one hotel in order to get out with $325,000.
It's tempting to join the bath of cynicism here about settlements. We all, being news reporters, are what we really are aggrieved over here is not the fact that the system of justice worked like systems of justices work, where there are settlements and agreements. It's that we didn't get to see the emails that we presume might have been there from the Malloy camp to donors saying, give it over there and we'll get it.
But would you make it sound like journalists are the only people who could possibly care about that?
No, it's not that we are the only people. It's that we make a living caring about that. And
yeah.
So it's a nice way to have, you know, your day is more interesting if you're writing about crazy stuff that you're uncovering than if you're writing about, you know, I don't know, the pancakes. You know.
Well, there's an argument to be made. Well, now we will never know what exactly happened in this case. And there was one of the former regulators who has since retired contacted me and he was like, it's about more than the mailings here. You know, there was about $1 million spent on staffing and other things that were never reimbursed to the state account that were used for non-federal candidates, for state candidates. So it's about more than the mailings here. And that's what the subpoena was trying to get at. And, you know, Dan Clough, who's an attorney, and he has read all of the briefs in this case. And, you know, he thinks that the regulators, the SEC, had a point and could have won in court.
I also – look, I think the other thing is, like, why do settlements happen? Why do settlements happen in criminal cases? And Dan's right. I mean, they happen a lot, right? And when they do happen, to Christine's point, we often wind up not knowing things that would be really important to know for the future. So, in fact, this guy we're going to be talking about in a few minutes, John Rowland, ultimately in his first case in court, wound up sort of settling for, you know, pleading guilty on a very limited basis. So there was no further discovery. We didn't find out all kinds of things that would have been useful to know about the state of the Connecticut government, how many agencies had been corrupted in this really pervasive way. So you don't find those things out. So why do they happen? Well, sometimes they happen because prosecutors think maybe this is the best that we can get. And if we roll the dice, first of all, we're going to be committing a lot of resources to a trial. And what if we don't win? You know, what if we get nothing? I don't see how this obtains in this particular case. Like, I don't understand why SEEK would think, well, there really might be a downside to us pursuing this to its limits. That's kind of all they do,
isn't
right?
That the whole job?
Yeah, that's their job. So it's not like – I just don't understand. I don't understand what the upside would be for them to take this up.
Well, and the point of the Rowland case, we may all feel like we wish we knew more about what John Rowland did or did not do. But that was a man who is facing jail time, and that's his right to try to limit what he's going to serve. I mean, at the end of the day, John Rowland has a responsibility to him and his family. The SEC doesn't have anything like that whatsoever. There's no reason that I can figure out to settle.
No. And you know, ultimately what you wind up doing, too, is undermining confidence, everybody's confidence in this system. I do not blame conservative comment trolls on the Hartford Current website who say, well, why does John Rowland have to suffer all these consequences? And then when you catch the Democrats doing something, they just give you some money and it's all over. I mean, I wouldn't blame anybody who found that to be disturbing. I realize one thing's at the state level, one's at the federal level, but that's not the point. People see that and they wonder. They wonder whether this system makes any sense at all. And can I just say, Common Cause, you are so on the wrong side of this. For Common Cause, which is a good government organization, to say that this was a good settlement, that this was acceptable in some way, indicates a level of blindness that I just also find incomprehensible.
You're the least cynical person here, Danny. I'm
the
surprised.
Well, part of the question is whether the 325, which is 16 and a half times bigger than the previous high, isn't that what you reported, Christine? The 60 to 20,000, right? Is a painful thing, right? And often we see settlements, especially on Wall Street, with hedge fund violations and the big banks that Bank of America pays $5 billion. Well, of course, that's nothing. $325,000 is still a fairly significant
on an installment pain. Plan. They basically buy him a car every year.
But the other thing, the more important point is that it must have been that they were fairly careful about sending a message to donors that you can get around the rule, or else one of us would have come up with some of these things. Because if they're really out there floating around, they should be still available to us.
Or they paid $325,000 because they had said such reckless and intemperate things in their emails.
Those are the two options.
Those would be option A and option B. Talking about the way things happen and at the state capitol, Governor Dan Malloy vetoed 8 bills that passed through the legislature this year. Lawmakers reconvened this week and decided to override 3 of those bills. Christine, maybe you can take us through a little bit of this, because there are some bills that they overrode, and there are some bills they decided not to override. Brendan Sharkey, House Speaker, said, this shows that we have independence from the governor. It's in some ways a little surprising that Democrats break from the governor. Maybe given the poll numbers for the governor right now, it's not so surprising, and some of the bad feelings between those in the legislature and those in the executive branch. But take us through a little bit of what got overridden here.
Yeah, so the bills that did get overridden, so they had to be passed by 2/3 in both chambers, was a bill that rebids a contract for non-medical transportation, another that would allow Denise Napier to decide the salary of her chief investment officer, and then a bill that expands the amount of analysis state agencies would have to do before adopting regulations that affect small business. And so, none of these were really all – none of the 8 bills that the governor vetoed were really controversial. the largest amount of no votes they had against one was 7. So, I mean, it was like unanimous or near unanimous that they passed both chambers of the legislature. So Malloy was vetoing bills that pretty much had consensus.
So let's talk about a couple of the bills that didn't, though. I mean, one would have, I'm ready here, implemented recommendations by the legislature's auditors of public accounts, expanded who must report suspected wrongdoing in the Office of State Ethics, and tightened the rules for contracting without competitive bidding. That actually sounds like something that might be something that lawmakers might want to take up.
Oh, yeah. A good government bill? Yeah. No, of course. It's something
bill?
That they – yeah. So the House did pass that bill, and the Senate declined to take it up.
Malloy at the time said two sections of the bill, in his words, encroach upon the purview of the executive branch of government.
Most of the bills that he vetoed, he felt encroached on the executive yeah. branch's power. So the legislature was going to, you know, stand up against that. And I believe that the House did by seeking to override at least 5 of those bills. And the Senate declined. The Senate only sought to override 4 of them, and then 1 didn't get taken up in the House.
The other one, though, this House Bill 5636, this had to do with assessing the state's economic development tax incentives. This is the one that Kevin Limbo and other people were pushing fairly hard for. Malloy said that this bill would have allowed owners or shareholders of S corporations, limited liability companies, to claim an apprenticeship tax credit against their personal income tax. He called the legislature's takeover of the analysis unnecessary and unwarranted. What I think this was getting at, though, Christine, was actually trying to figure out a way to look more deeply at the tax incentives that are being doled out by the administration. That's something that is something a lot of people, Democrats, Republicans, a lot of us are trying to look at.
Right. So every 3 years, the Economic and Community Development Agency, which gives out these tax credits, is supposed to review these tax credits. And that would just hand the power over to the legislature's Program and Review Investigations Committee to do. And I think Dan has something to say on this. He's chomping at the bit.
I would join the cynics here to say that it was unnecessary because we know that the executive branch does such a great job of analyzing how these tax credits are working. They amount to some $400 million. And actually, that's an old number from 2012. They're probably more. And we really have no idea what they're doing because the analysis is so weak.
I just want to say this right now, that there's a CTN viewer who's going, hey, forget about the microwave popcorn. Get on in here. They're talking about the Program Review and Investigation Committee. Hey, just pause it. Pause it. Pause it while I go use the bathroom. I don't want to miss any of this.
Look, yes, we are talking about some fairly wonky stuff, Christine. I guess my note in all this is that these two bills that I just outlined actually seem to have something to do with ethics, good government, accountability, transparency, the things that we were talking about just a moment ago. Why exactly is it that we didn't see overrides of those two things that did indeed have large support from the legislature?
So it was because the administration and the Senate have a little bit of a cozier relationship and that the governor's administration was able to get the Senate to adjourn before they raised any of these bills.
This is sort of also kind of why Dan Clow, I think this is why Dan Clow says there's 7 branches of government, because you have to count all the constitutional officers. So Kevin Limbo really is kind of functioning as a branch of government now, saying, wait a minute. The way you do it isn't right, and the legislature should help me make you do it the right way.
But he might be running for governor.
He might be running for governor, yeah. So I just, to me, this is a little bit, I wrote in our notes, you know, cue video of mouse rising up on its hind legs to paw the air ferociously with its tiny little hands. I mean, you know, this was not much of a rebellion as things go. And the other thing to remember, particularly because I've noticed some of the remarks by Representative Themis Claridis, is, Dan Malloy, as Doug Schwartz keeps pointing out, is incredibly unpopular. What Doug Schwartz always forgets to point out is the legislature is exactly as unpopular as Dan Malloy, right down to the crosstabs in the Q poll. The legislature, I mean, when these Q polls in which Malloy does so poorly, they really are statements about how people feel about state government in general. They think the legislature is a bunch of monkey heads, too.
Yeah, they're at 24% too.
I want to point out there were some policy disputes between Malloy and the legislature in this. It wasn't just about power between the executive and legislative branches. The business of whether you give tax credits to – and I don't – Colin, we're going to take this over the cliff – to type S corporations. A type S company is basically you operating a company out of your pocket versus registering it as a company. And as it happens, one of the main proponents of that bill was Representative help me out if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, Salim Nujaim from Waterbury, who owns a machine shop. His family owns a machine shop. It's a type S company, meaning it's not an incorporated business.
It's actually not.
It's not a type S.
No, it's not a type S.
He wanted type S companies to get
– Correct.
That. Okay. So I stand corrected about it being
but
a type S
company.
But his
company is not.
His company is not. Okay, good. Because that would have been – that could have possibly been a conflict. I wouldn't have accused him because he was acting in good faith. But the point is he wanted type S companies, non-incorporated companies, to get the same tax break. That's a dispute between Malloy and the legislature that's not just about power. I think that he's wrong and Malloy is right. If you're going to get a tax break, you should pay the underlying tax that you're getting a break on.
This is the part where they go to a commercial and CTN and they say, we're talking about type S corporations now. Look, hey, here's what we'll do. We'll use this as a way to transition. Because you talked about Waterbury, former governor turned radio host turned wedding planner John Rowland lost his appeal to overturn his conviction related to involvement in a congressional race. It looks, Colin, now like it's finally over for John Rowland.
Yeah, but to be fair, I think he was a salesperson for a wedding. I don't think John Rowland actually plans your wedding, although that would be very interesting. This is an area in which the human being I'm trying to be intersects with maybe the policy-oriented journalist that I also am trying to be. So, and the human being, basically, in some ways I look at this whole thing and I think, all right, point made, you know, what's the real purpose of this guy spending a lot more time in prison? And I think I would say that if he were – and this is sort of a human argument, not a legal one. If I felt that he were really capable of demonstrating any serious understanding of what he has done in both of his cases, not just this one but back in 2004 too, that if he had a real genuine sense of contrition, if he could make some kind of statement that really seemed genuine, acknowledging that he's done something wrong and that he really has disgraced first his office and then flouted laws with the intent to deceive the public about what he's doing. That's basically what he's in trouble for this time. You'd sort of think, well, maybe we just forget the whole thing. You're getting old. Maybe you shouldn't be in prison. But I also understand Janet Arterton's desire and also the reason that the appeal didn't go very far, which is, you know, we got to have a system where – provided you are not the Democratic State Central Committee, if you do something wrong, you get punished. Otherwise, we have no system. And basically what these guys did was say, you know, screw the system. We'll make up our own rules and we'll fool everybody. And that's why probably he's going to have to go to prison. But, I don't know. I'm reaching an age where I don't feel as good about this as maybe I used to.
Well, and the sentence wasn't as harsh as it could have been. And, Rob Braddock, who was the deputy finance director for Chris Donovan's campaign, got sentenced to 38 months. So Rowland only got 30 months. So, he'll be out in a halfway house probably in about, a year and a half.
I forgot about poor Rob Braddock.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's going to get a year off the term. When I ran into him at a parade last July 4th, and I can't believe it's coming up on a year since he was well into the defense or the appeal at the time, he believed that two of the seven counts were going to – he was going to win done deal, and he was going to try and leverage the fact that those two counts were wrongly prosecuted having to do with the discovery against the other five. That was essentially the core of the strategy, and he was confident of the first two but not of the others. And I think what it tells you is just exactly what Colin said. He's still in the weeds of the technicalities of the government discovery, which is not a position of contrition. And I agree.
The other arguments were kind of boilerplate appeal
that's right.
arguments,
that's
you know,
right.
jury
that's
instructions
right.
and stuff like that.
That's right.
We're talking in the wheelhouse today with Dan Haar, columnist of the Hartford Current, Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to talk about what we can learn about Donald Trump from Republicans right here in Connecticut. We'll also hear about some stories that we haven't been talking about in this week's news. It's coming up next on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse here on WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, joined by Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Dan Haar, a columnist for The Hartford Current. Quickly, U.S. Senate campaign of August Wolf has officially come to an end. The Republican hopeful failed to collect enough signatures to get onto the primary ballot and announced yesterday that he was suspending his campaign. Colin, he's going to throw his support behind Dan Carter, who's going to take over in this race against Dick Blumenthal.
Yeah, I mean, First, he failed to get the 15% at the convention that would have allowed him to primary, and then he failed. I mean, the number's too high. It's 8,000. That's just way too many signatures to have to collect. Although people do it, they get it done. He didn't get it done. He was a little over five. I sound like Donald Trump. He didn't get it done. he only got 5,000 signatures. That's not enough. this is going to sound very cynical, but I'm not really sure that this matters all that much. I mean, he wasn't a very good candidate. Dan Carter probably is not going to stand much of a chance. He's basically the goat that they stake out in Jurassic Park for the Tyrannosaurus to come eat. Tyrannosaurus being Dick Blumenthal.
although he did this week, Dan Carter sent out a statement this morning going very hard after Senator Blumenthal for politicizing the events of Orlando along with others. We were talking about guns before, and Dan Carter is trying to get at Dick Blumenthal that way.
Well, there are plenty of points on policy that Dan Carter can make, and he's going to make them, and he's going to be the loyal would-be opposition. But he will get the requisite 41%. It's hard to not get that much because there is that much opposition, especially in a year like this. And it's hard to beat 43, which is the highest ever against a Democrat since 88.
Can I just save us all an email from Al Robinson? All right. So Dan Carter represents part of his district, includes some of Newtown. He was the only person representing Newtown who voted against the assault rifle ban. I just saved us an email from Al Robinson.
Very quickly, Christine, who's Dan Carter?
Dan Carter is a state representative from Bethel. You know, he served in Desert Storm. What was it? C-1? Is it C-130? The plane? He was a C-130 pilot.
That's the transport.
Yeah, the transport one. He served for three terms in the state house. We hardly knew you.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is expected to go on the offensive against Hillary Clinton today. In the last week, he's been playing more defense after terrible finance numbers were released. He fired his campaign manager. He got widespread criticism for his response to the Orlando shooting. All these issues have renewed interest in the anti-Trump movement among Republicans. And Dan, you've been writing about this. I mean, what's the role of Connecticut Republicans in this dump Trump effort?
Well, it turns out that the role of Connecticut Republicans is to be loyal Donald Trump delegates. You would think, and that's what I wrote today, you would think that Connecticut would be a great hotbed of anti-Trump backlash. But it turns out in part because of the fact that Trump won 58% and the delegates were hand-chosen. Unlike in the Democratic system where the delegates are actually elected in caucuses. You could have gone on May 31st since you didn't go to a Yard Goats game. That night, any Democrat could have gone to elect the delegates in caucuses. The Republicans don't have that. They're all handpicked, and in this case, by the Trump campaign and checked off by the Republican State Committee. So for those reasons, and because the Republicans who were opposed to Trump really – they weren't even in the game. It wasn't they were so far opposed to Trump that they're not in the delegate game. There is no crack in the facade.
And you sound surprised?
I am surprised because it's such a non-Trump type of state in terms of bearing and style. We're such a button-down Republican state. Why would somebody not come out and say, "You know, you guys are right."
Well, first of all, I mean, pay no attention to J.R. Romano. Nobody listens to J.R. Romano. Pay attention to the fact that Ben Proto, one of the smarter behind-the-scenes Republican guys, is now on the Rules Committee for the convention. So one of the things they've got to make sure is – I think it's 57 votes or something like that. They've got to make sure that that an insurgent group can't get in there somehow and change the convention rules to liberate delegates. And so Ben Proto, who's a veteran of the two major McCain campaigns here in Connecticut, very smart guy, knows what he's doing, is one of the people helping Donald Trump fend off such a challenge. That may be a lot more significant than anything J.R. Romano says.
We've heard from some prominent state Republicans like Themis Claridis, Christine, people who, you know, were critical of Trump and now are throwing their support behind Trump. I mean, there's something really real happening for Republicans in the state. So there's Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, but there's also a real good chance that they could make some headway in these statewide elections, and they need to kind of play this the right way for themselves.
Well, that's true. In 2008, Obama had some long coattails, and I guess it remains to be seen how long Donald Trump's coattails are. The Senate is, you know, a few candidates away from winning control of that chamber. Governing Magazine actually said that, you know, it's possible that Republicans could take over that chamber. I'm a little bit more skeptical. But, you know, Republicans could make gains this year if they bring out people who normally don't come out to vote because they like Donald Trump.
But to Dan's point, what we don't have here in Connecticut is the Larry Hogan or the Larry Pressler, for that matter, or the Jeff Flake or the Mark Kirk or there. I mean, all over America now, there are prominent Republicans either saying they're sitting this whole thing out, a la Bush 41, Bush 43, or they're voting for Hillary Clinton in some cases. I mean, prominent Republicans have now announced that they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And you've got the Lindsey Grahams and you've got the Kasichs and stuff like that. And we just, to your point, Dan, we don't have that person here.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Right. I just also want to make the point that just about everybody that I talked with who's a Republican, whether they're for Trump or not, is apologizing for Trump in some form, Themis Claridis included, in some way apologizing for Donald Trump. It's the nominee that nobody loves all the way.
Just very quickly, Colin, can you just talk about Maureen Dowd's column? Because you would put up something about this. I mean, here's someone who's sort of been, in many ways, carrying water for the candidate up until this point, and now making a little bit of a turn.
Yeah, I mean, she on Sunday published this column in the New York Times, basically saying that she had cut Donald Trump a lot of slack because she had private conversations with him in which he said he didn't mean it. He didn't mean a lot of the most objectionable, horrifying, extremist things that he was saying were kind of theater, and you know he really wasn't going to take it all that far. He just needed to win the primary battle, and then he'd be a different kind of candidate in the general. And I just don't even think there exists within the world of journalism a lot of room for this kind of arrangement. You either judge people on the public on their public record, or you say, I know something, you know, that is not on the public record. But you don't sit there, you don't let somebody promise you this kind of stuff and not declare it. I mean, this is how you get into trouble, and this is how our profession starts to lose credibility, too. So I was kind of shocked that, A, she had done this, and, B, that she saw no shame in it.
Okay, so we're almost out of time here on the show, and so I want to quickly go around and get some of the ideas from the outer sphere this week, some of the stories that maybe all of us haven't been paying attention to. Christine, you've got a nice story to tell. I like that.
I do. So I went shopping at the West Hartford Aldi last weekend and brought my 16-month-old daughter, who brought her stuffed animal brown horse with her and at some point lost it during the trip.
Ah.
And I was practically in tears. She was fine. went back to look for it. Couldn't find it. Left my number with them. And 5 minutes after leaving the store, some customer had turned it in. And we went back to retrieve it.
That is lovely. So somebody actually did the right thing. Your little girl gets her horsey back. Your story brought up some flashbacks to me. I actually, about the same age as her, I lost my toy called Jingle Doggy. And Jingle Doggy is lost in a store somewhere in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. Thank you for sharing a nice story. Dan, what do you got?
I was going to talk about how I was driving around Cromwell on Monday night and discovered a really cool isolated neighborhood while listening to Colin trying to fill a half an hour very well, I might add, without phones. But I really should quickly point out that at Hartford's on Pearl Street at the EBK Gallery?
Yes.
They're doing a sort of a storefront choreography series of sketches this week with Hartford's choreographer Arian Wilkerson. I think this is notable because it's a small event. We're always looking for big things in Hartford. This is the type of thing that makes a city a city.
Aaron is an amazing dancer and choreographer. Really, very highly recommended all this work. Colin, how about you?
Well, a few weeks ago, I watched all the way through before it dropped the OJ Made in America documentary series. It's about 8 hours long that ESPN is doing. It's really an amazing series, but it also stirred up a lot of Connecticut memories. Dominic Dunn, who lived in Hadleim, I think at the time, went out there and became sort of, you know, the court jester for a whole bunch of people, or maybe there's a better way to describe what he was doing out there. Henry Lee, of course, our famed crime scene investigator, went out there as a witness for the OJ defense, which a lot of people really never entirely forgave him for. But the thing that I would just sort of quickly point out is that what happened kind of afterwards was that Dunn and Mark Furman kind of knew each other. Furman was looking for a case that he could establish himself on or maybe clean up his reputation a little bit. And Dunn handed him the Martha Moxley case. And the two of them lobbied very heavily to get that case reopened and to get ultimately Michael Skakel put on the hot seat for it. So in some ways, everything that's happened to Michael Skakel, whose Supreme Court case I think is – sitting somewhere in the pipeline, whose Connecticut Supreme Court case is sitting somewhere in the pipeline, might even this summer maybe have a ruling on it. But all the things that happened to Michael Skakel are sort of traceable to the OJ case.
So interesting. My story is a story that I read in a few places, including WMPR.org. For everyone who's ever tried to travel to the lovely beaches of eastern Connecticut on a summer day, and I sure have, there's one problem. Route 9, which is otherwise a limited access highway connecting Farmington to Old Saybrook, it stops dead at a series of confusing traffic lights in the shadow of the Aragone Bridge. Well, Governor Malloy says no more.
There are 60 accidents, serious accidents, caused by this traffic light in the middle of a highway per year. This goes all the way back to the 1950s. It is outrageous, quite frankly, that the state tolerated that for such a long period of time without coming up with an appropriate design to fix it.
So there's a design now. Now, it might not be ready until 2023, but they're going to build some bridges. They're going to take out the stoplight. You'll be able to go unencumbered all the way down to the shoreline, and that makes me very happy this week. Thanks very much to Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who you can hear at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. This program is produced by Tucker Eyes with help from Kyone Wolf. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.